This episode is brought to you by DistroKid.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, geeks and nerds. Today's guest is Milo Aukerman, lead vocalist for Manhattan Beach, California punk rockers, The Descendants. Together, we take a deep dive into the writing, recording, inspiration, release, and legacy behind the fan-favorite song Hope, taken from their 1982 debut full-length album, Milo Goes to College. Although he wouldn't mention her by name, Milo did say that the song was written about an ex-girlfriend. He talked about her initial feelings about the song, and what drummer Bill Stevenson thought of it when he first showed it to him. We got into the recording process, which was basically the band playing live, with very few overdubs, and how this frenetic energy of youth and sheer enthusiasm within the track can still be heard to this day. Milo never thought in a million years that songs he wrote as a teenager would become the blueprint for the pop-punk explosion of the early 90s, and would also give him a career in music that has lasted now over 40 years. And Milo was quick to throw Bill under the bus regarding a certain lyric in the song that without just wouldn't be the same. For all this and a whole lot of hope, stick around. This is a fun one.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
Milo, what's happening?
Not much, just hanging out in Delaware.
Old Delaware, you're still there, huh?
Yeah.
Awesome, man. It kind of goes without saying, I think probably 99.9% of my listeners know who you and the Descendants are, so there's not much of an introduction here. But I'm super stoked to have you on today, and there's so many songs. And a lot of times, Chris, my producer, and I will go on Spotify, or we'll go see how many YouTube plays a certain track has. And, you know, there was a couple of them, you know, Get the Time, Sour Grapes, but I decided to go with Hope to break down today. And I want you to take us back. You know, Milo Goes to College, the first full length from Descendants, was released September 4th, 1982 on New Alliance Records. New Alliance Records, I did not know this. Dee Boone and Mike Watt from the Minutemen started that label. And then SST, of course, Greg Ginn from Black Flag, SST had acquired the label later, but it came out September 4th, 82, which is closing in on 40 years of this song being released, which is unreal to me. And take us back to this time period when you wrote the song. Do you remember writing it?
Yeah, well, I guess the song itself probably is 40 years old because I probably wrote it in that kind of like spring period. I mean, actually, I finished the last lyric probably summer of 82. It was one of these songs where I had a piece of music and I didn't have words yet. And I hadn't really written any songs for the band. I mean, not full-fledged my own songs. I'd written a song called Eunuch Boy where I wrote the lyrics and Tony wrote the music. In his pocket, eunuch boy, fellow boy, another toy, game like the day, a school. They try to stop us. And then for M16, again, Tony music, my words. Don't shoot, don't man the team. Don't shoot, don't man the team. Don't shoot, don't man the team. I'm not gonna live, don't man the dream. But this was my first attempt at actually writing the music itself. And so at that point, I didn't know what I was doing. I just strung a bunch of chords together. And I probably had just learned minor chords. So I was like, cool, minor chords, those are cool. So I think this one has a bunch of minor chords in it, which I was kind of like having fun with playing and strung them together and came up with basically the entirety of the, you know, the song with music only. Then something I as songwriters are, you know, want to do is just obsessively play that over and over again. Cause hey, this sounds cool. I just want to keep playing this. I must've played it, you know, for hours and hours. And I think I showed it to my girlfriend and she said, the chords are all wrong. And I said, oh, thanks.
Now, what did she mean by the chords are wrong though?
I don't know. I mean, maybe from a classical music perspective, it kind of shifts around a little bit. It's maybe not not entirely in a key or something, or maybe probably the minor chords are all wrong, or like some of those minor chords are not in the right place, whatever. I didn't care. I was going to keep going with it because it felt good to play it. So then I showed it to Bill. I said, hey, here's these chords I put together. I think this is a song, but I don't have any words for it. And played him the chords and he goes, oh, that's so hopeful sounding. It's the song that inspires hope. And I go, oh, okay. Yeah. I get that feeling too. It's like kind of, you know, it's got these minor chords. I mean, minor chords can feel sad, but they can also feel hopeful, I guess. I don't know. And so then it became the song that inspires hope. And I just shortened it to hope and then had to write lyrics, to, you know, I guess to reflect that part of it. And that's where I actually wrote them, about my girlfriend. Her name's Beep Beep. Yeah,
that's I like your self-editing there. That was great. You know, the passage of time is a crazy thing as we get older. And I remember when Less Than Jake did our first tour with you guys on the Caffeine Nation in 97, I remember thinking like, wow, you know, Milo goes to college, that record's 15 years old. And it seemed like a lifetime away, another dimension of time. And yet the last 25 years since then, it seemed like they went by in a flash. It's just, it's crazy. But I think I know the answer to this question, but when you wrote it, did you ever fathom that 40 years later, you'd still be talking about it and people would go absolutely nuts at shows for this?
Well, no, I wasn't even supposed to be a musician at this point. I was supposed to be a scientist, perhaps a full professor was the long-term dream. And obviously I'm not a full professor, not a scientist anymore. And so you just can't predict how your life's going to go. And I just feel like you just have to roll with the changes. And I set myself up to have a few different irons in the fire and just tried to keep those irons going because I was really like kind of, you know, obsessively excited about music and about science. So I thought, well, I mean, I want to do both these things. How can I make that happen? Of course, you can't really make that happen, but I tried my best to kind of keep my two passions going. And I think that's what helped me in the long run, because when one of them started to kind of wither on the vine, I just kind of went to the other one. I would have never thought it was the science that was going to wither on the vine, but that's in fact what happened.
You know, something I don't get into too much on the show here, but when I get some of the veterans, the punk legends on here, I like to ask, because, you know, you guys paved the way for bands like mine and all the bands that came after you. I mean, there was a danger to punk rock, an element of danger back then. You were the places were always in the rundown parts of town. It was sketchy. There was stabbings. There was skinheads. You saw it all. What did your folks think of this? Because you were a good kid. You were kind of nerdy. You wanted to be a scientist. You got good grades, I'm presuming. And here you are hanging out with Bill, going doing these shows. What was the climate like at home during this?
Well, I think they first started worrying probably when I decided I graduated high school. And, you know, I think my parents were looking at me like, okay, now you're going to go to college. And I said, no, I'm going to go to the local community college. I'm going to go to this place, El Camino Community College. And I think the jaws hit the floor. Like, what? It's like, you're supposed to be going to a real university. And I said, well, I'm digging the band right now. And I was assured that I could go to this community college for a year and then transfer the credits in somewhere else. So I kind of had to reassure them, look, it's still in the plan, but I'm enjoying this band and I just want to kind of keep rolling with it. And in the meantime, I will pursue some education at this local community college. It all worked out, but yeah, I think that was their first kind of suggestion to them. Like, oh man, this guy can't tear himself away from this life. It's this whole punk rock life thing. So, yeah.
And what was the, because, you know, punk rockers in 1982 were outcasts. What was the allure for you then? What was it about it for this suburban teenage kid that you just, you were drawn to?
I think it was the fact that it was outcasts, because I kind of felt like we all had to find our people, you know, and I found my people in Bill, obviously, and Frank and Tony. We were all outcasts in the band. And I think just being at school and dealing with not fitting in and that whole thing, I think punk rock became a place where you could fit in. I mean, you're fitting in by not fitting in with it. You're fitting in by sharing that kind of anger of not fitting in with it, with all these other punk rockers. And that's kind of where we all could kind of bond together just over, you know, kind of being the outcasts. I think, you know, you got to celebrate that. You can't just kind of like, you know, just,
yeah.
It's like, well, if you're an outcast, what are you gonna do? Try to be someone that you're not? And you got to be who you want to be. So I think that's what punk rock, you know, afforded me, basically.
Yeah, you show up at the shows like, I'm confused. So am I. Let's hang out. I mean,
yep.
You know, one thing I always admired about Descendants that I loved, at least on the outside, it looked like a very democratic process with the songwriting. Everyone got songwriting credits, even the later members. Of course, on Milo Goes to College, we had Tony Lombardo on bass and Frank Navetta on the guitar, the original band. And then, of course, Stefan and Carl came in later. But everyone always had an opportunity to write. Was that the way from the get-go? Were you ever intimidated to show something to Bill? Or was that always kind of the way that it was?
No, it was always that way. I think the first... You know, the band was started by Frank. And so he came in with a whole bunch, you know, songs right off the bat. Tony was next with like, hey, I think I can contribute here. And every new person that came in and contributed was like, yeah, more songs. Good. You know, because no one was going to sit there and go, I just wrote 30 songs. I mean, we all wrote our kind of fair share. And there was never any kind of like monopolization of that. I came into the band and they already had a full set of songs that were not my songs. At that point was kind of like, this is cool because I don't really know how to write songs anyways. But you know, probably within the first month of me joining the band, Tony was like, dude, write a song. And I go, I don't know how to write a song. And he said, okay, just write a lyric and I'll write a song with it. And that's when I brought in Unique Boy and he wrote the music for that. You know, he must've been laughing his head off while he was writing it. But I mean, so that just goes to show you, I mean, we were all just kind of like, not only encouraged, but like, hey, if you're in this band, you need to write some songs. You know, that was kind of the expectation. And that would continued even after Tony and Frank left, because then we had Doug and Ray and, you know, both, yeah. You know, Doug came in with these great songs. He wrote Sour Grapes with me.
What I say, why?
And, you know, he wrote some other songs on that Enjoy record that are really great. So it's just kind of like get started from the very start of just the expectation that everyone's going to write. You know, even Stefan writes now. In fact, he's the most prolific songwriter in the band now.
Well, a couple of things. You mentioned Unique Boy a couple of times. That didn't make an appearance on a record until 1996 with Everything Sucks. So was that written back in the day and you just didn't record it till then?
Yeah, it was written back when I joined, but never put on anything. I don't know. I think Bill kind of resurrected, like, hey, won't this be funny to put on to I Don't Want to Grow Up? There was a few others that were like that. We were just kind of like, huh, these are these ones that just didn't belong. They didn't belong on Milo Goes to College. But then we thought, well, you know, we thought they were funny and would provide a nice funny element to I Don't Want to Grow Up. That, so we put them on that. Actually, no, it wasn't on I Don't Want to Grow Up. That was on like Everything Sucks. You're right.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, yeah, okay. It was 96. So yeah,
that was Resurrector from way on back. Yeah, okay. I got confused with this other song, No FB, that ended up on I Don't Want to Grow Up. That was Resurrected. Unfortunately, was Resurrected. Shouldn't have.
Something I always loved about the band again is the continuity between Tony and Frank, Doug and Ray, and then Carl and Stefan. It all kind of felt like this one cohesive. It wasn't like, oh, there's a completely different sound happening. There was a cohesion here within the band that I always respected. And something else I didn't know while I was researching for this episode, I don't know how I didn't know this, probably because I never saw you with Tony back in the day, but he was about 20 years older than you guys, right?
Yeah. When he joined the band, at some point, someone had the curiosity to ask him, just how old are you anyway? I think Bill might have confronted him. Like, we need to know how old you are. And he wouldn't, I don't think he would tell them or it took him a while to finally fess up to Bill, because I think he felt like Bill was just going to be like shocked. And he was, about 20 years old in this. And so Bill just kind of tucked that little tidbit away. It's kind of like, okay, because you know, Tony wanted to keep it on low. It's one of those things, you're only as old as you feel. But I think Tony was just like, man, I don't want to be seen as the geezer.
Well, yeah, because I remember going to shows, you know, at 17, 18, 19 years old. And if there was anybody over 30 there, you knew it.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Tony, though, is that his musical tastes were so, you know, juvenile. I mean, he was loving X-Ray Specs and all these, you know, teeny bopper punk bands. And I think he because his tastes kind of veered in that direction, he could be young at heart and be in the band, basically. I mean, he wrote some of the most juvenile lyrics we have, too. So,
yeah, which is awesome. And, you know, the album, of course, recorded the tape. There was no Pro Tools back then. It was produced by Glenn Lockett, who professionally goes by Spot. And he was best known for being a house producer and engineer for SST Records. So when you went to record this, obviously you were, had been playing these songs out live, and back in the day you had to be well rehearsed because you were, you know, recording studios cost a lot of money. When you got in there, was Hope recorded kind of off the floor and you just dubbed vocals afterwards, or how much of a overdubs and things that were happening at that time?
Well, I think what they would do is at that point play guitar, bass, drums in a room with some baffling, with some, you know, maybe the drums were in a separate room, but at any rate, it was the guitar, bass, drums were live. And there was probably some overdubbing of guitars afterwards. And then, of course, the vocal is just kind of done on its own later than that. I can remember them putting down Hope and thinking, cool, this is my first song. And then realizing, uh-oh, I need to finish writing the lyrics. It's like, because I'd probably written like a first verse chorus and maybe I'd written everything but the bridge. And so the bridge, I hadn't really written yet. It was written musically, but I had no words for it. So then I think I was scrambling around in the studio as my time to kind of sing it came upon me. And I just had to finish writing the bridge. Yeah.
And how hard at this point, because, you know, Bill wasn't producing, it was Spot, but how hard was Bill on you for vocal performances? Because, man, I've heard some stories from Scott Reynolds. Of course, it's been documented in the Descendants movie, and Chad Price has talked about it. Like, Bill was just cracking the whip in there. And was it just kind of like you got in front of the mic and did your thing? Or was there, hey, you know, was he feeding you note choices or melody choices? Or how was that process?
A couple things. One is that we had practiced these songs so much that there was not going to be any kind of like in the studio kind of like, oh, I guess I need to learn the song. No, or any of that. And because we practiced them so much, I kind of knew what kind of oomph to give them. I knew what I wanted to sing. I can't say that any of them are one take only, but some of them are just like, you know, two or three takes only kind of thing. And that's fine because you got to run through the song a few times anyways. So yeah, I think we didn't struggle to get those takes because we'd kind of worked on these songs for so long before that point. We'd woodshed it. I guess they call it woodshed. We've woodshedded the songs. So it went pretty smoothly. The only thing I can remember is that there were a few songs that in the aftermath, I go, God, I kind of wish I would have asked Bill for more guidance, like his songs, like Bikage. Now, I sang that song pretty much like, you know, I'm singing the tonic the whole song. It's kind of like I'm singing very few notes and I'm just kind of belting it out. And that works. That works pretty well. But I kind of feel like maybe he wanted something more than that. And either he was unwilling to kind of suggest it to me, or he maybe felt like, well, this is where Milo's at as a singer, or this is his sound and I don't want to mess with his sound. But there were a few songs like Bikage where he probably wanted something a little more melodic than that. And I wasn't asking about it and I wasn't getting the suggestion from him. So it is what it is.
Yeah. One more thing before we dive into the track. Do you recall start to finish how many days it took to record Milo Goes to College?
I think it was probably 2 weeks. I think I probably spent maybe 3 or 4 days singing max. I would say max 3 or 4 days singing. So there was no kind of belaboring. it was just kind of like, you know, part of this is, well, not part, all of it is related to studio time, obviously. You don't even have time to, any more time than that to do it. I mean, it's one of these things these days with the, you know, the advent of, you know, Pro Tools or whatever, you don't have that limitation so much on studio time, or you know, at least you can kind of go, oh, we'll sing it five times through and then we'll just stitch, do the old stitcheroo.
Yeah.
Back then you were so limited by purchasing studio time that, I mean, I guess there's a sense of urgency to it all. There's just kind of like you get that raw or maybe more punk performance out of it.
Well, yeah. And like you said, you were out playing the songs. You had to be well rehearsed because you were spending 30, 40, 50 bucks an hour to record. It's like, let's go in, and there's an urgency to it. And I think that's why a lot of people, me as a fan, can relate to this, is a lot of times the band's first records are our favorite. There was an immediacy to it. There was a punch to it.
Most bands' first records, you'd been playing those songs for like 2 years. And so you get in there like, and it's this sense of huge release. Like finally, these songs we played for 2 years, we can just commit them to vinyl or commit them to tape. It makes for a different experience than, say, when you're on records 5, 6, and 7, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, we're going to jump into the song right now. The intro, it's an 8-bar intro. The song's 1 minute and 58 seconds, just under that 2 minute mark. Right off the top, the band is in guitar, bass, and drums. I love the chord progression. I think your girlfriend was wrong about this one. I think it's perfect. F sharp, C sharp, D to A. It's great. I'm calling this the chorus riff. You know, the chorus in this song we'll get to in a moment is kind of part of the verse. And I think that's what I love so much about it. It's like, wait, is this a chorus or is this still part of the verse? And I think that's great. The guitars, do you recall if they were stereo guitars or was this just one up the middle? It's hard for me to tell. It sounds like it's just one guitar and one bass and maybe some overdubs.
I don't remember what Frank was doing, but I imagine there might have been more than one guitar in there. It does sound full, you know.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with it. It probably was stereos, but it kind of has this like you're just listening to a band in a room that you threw up a couple mics and recorded, and I think it's great. The verse changes from that opening riff, goes into B minor, and I think that's kind of what Bill was talking about. It kind of lifts there, it kind of gives you this hopeful feeling. That's at least that's what I get from it.
Why can't you say you talk to me?
Why can't you see? You torture me. You're already thinking about someone else. When he comes home, you'll be in his arms, and I'll be gone. But I know my day will come. I know someday I'll be the only one. Where did that inspiration come from, lyrically?
It's kind of just me talking to my girlfriend. I mean, it's, I'm trying to think. We don't really write a lot from just kind of like imagination. We tend to write more from just experience. Mm-hmm. I guess I learned that from just listening to Bill's songs and Frank's songs, and where it's just basically, you know, they're going to talk about their relationships, and that's what this is. So it's just my girlfriend at the time was actually looking to break up with me. We hadn't maybe completed the breakup, but we were in the midst of the breakup. She had already informed me that her ex-boyfriend was coming back from the Navy, and she was saying to me, well, as soon as he comes back, I think I'm going to go back with him. And so that's just to let you know.
So I was like, oh, jeez.
Okay. Okay. So that's the, you know, you're torturing me here. I mean, you're already thinking about someone else. When he comes home, well, you'll be in his arms, I'll be gone. Almost because the song was supposed to inspire hope. I just felt like, well, I'm going to dig in my heels. And I'm going to say, no, my day will come, you know.
Well, I'm considering the chorus, the line, but I know my day will come. I know someday I'll be the only one, because it goes back to that intro F sharp, C sharp, D, A riff at the top.
Yeah, that's the chorus.
Yeah, yeah. And there's something else wild in here. And that's why I love doing this podcast, Milo. I've heard this song, I don't know how many times, hundreds, maybe 1,000 times over the years. And when I got into the headphones and I listened to it and dissected it about 30 times over the past few days, the backing vocals here on the lines, when he comes home, you'll be in his arms and I'll be gone. but I know my day will come. And then there's nothing that I know someday, but on the last line, I'll be the only one.
When it comes home, your bed is on and I'll be gone. But I know my day will come. I know someday I'll be the only one.
The backing vocals though were kind of unison, and everything is panned off to the right, the backing vocals, until that last line, I'll be the only one. All of a sudden, the backing vocals go left. They're in unison. They're not harmonies, and they're very loose. Nothing is locked here. Again, before Pro Tools, who was doing the backing vocals?
That's all Bill. He did all the backing vocals for that.
That's Bill. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, there were other things on Milo Goes to College where I would do the backing. I'd just do the backing, like double my voice, or actually, you know, do some very simple harmonies. But for Hope, it was all Bill doing backing vocals. So that was kind of fun to have him, you know, kind of contribute on that way. I guess he would know about the panning, what kind of panning was going on, because he was the one, you know, doing the backing vocal and kind of planning out how that was going to go. So, yeah.
Was Bill mixing with Spot at this point too? Or were you just getting mixes back from Spot? Be like, okay, that's cool. Or we want to change something. Or was Bill in there saying, hey, maybe we should pan? Cause it's really odd how everything's over in the right speaker. And then that last line, it goes over to the left. It's like, whoa, but it's very cool.
I'm sure Bill was in there with him. I don't know. You know, Bill didn't have any kind of technical know-how at that point to move any faders or anything like that. But I'm sure he was looking over Spot's shoulder, because he just had that kind of, you know, he was the guy who was going to make this, you know, the record that he wanted it to be, basically. So yeah, I think Bill definitely had some input for that, for sure. I mean, Spot's a genius, but Bill also kind of was in the mix, basically. Yeah,
that's so awesome. Well, immediately goes into verse two.
So now you wait for Spark.
So now you wait for his spark. You know it'll turn you on. He's going to make you feel the way you want to feel. When he starts to lie, when he makes you cry, you know I'll be there. My day will come. I know someday I'll be the only one.
I mean, how much of this is supposed to be me rehashing my relationship of years gone by? I don't know. Because that's kind of, I mean, if I were to talk about these lyrics, the only thing, I can't talk about how poetic or not poetic they are, or about what they really mean. It's pretty clear what they mean. It's,
yeah,
there's no subterfuge in any of this. And so there, she actually told me at some point, I'm not, you know, we don't have a spark and I want that spark. And I always had that spark with this other guy. So therefore that's what's going to happen. Yeah. So that just, I put it in the song like that. Like I said, I don't, that's why I call her Beep Beep, because I'm not going to say her name. It's like, this is getting too personal, man. No, it's not.
Does she know it's about her though?
Yeah. Yeah. I think she knew because, I told her, I think. Yeah, so.
The line here, he's going to make you feel the way you want to feel. The backing vocals, what Bill's doing is off to the right. The next line, same thing. But then my day will come. It switches to the left and I'll be the only one. It switches to the left, but it's super quiet this time from the first chorus. Again, I guess that was just the way it was mixed, or maybe Bill sung it a little quieter there and that's just how it went down.
Yeah, I think it just happenstance. I'm not sure if there's, I think I remember hearing that, yeah, and thinking like the backing vocals fluctuate a little bit in terms of where they are in the mix from the first to the second chorus, but you know, it's all cool. It's punk rock, you know.
Hey everybody, no need to wonder or be sad, nervous, or mad. There's plenty more with Milo Aukerman after a few quick words from our sponsors.
Looking to elevate your music career? DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that enables musicians to distribute their music to online stores and streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Tidal, and many more. DistroKid collects earnings and payments, sending them to you, the artist. With DistroKid, artists unlock a world of possibilities, from easily paying collaborators with splits to securing your music with DistroLock. DistroKid covers all bases. Plus, you can promote your releases with HyperFollow and create eye-catching visuals with a Spotify Canvas generator, all for free. But that's not all. Introducing the DistroKid app, now available on iOS and Android. Artists can manage their releases, view streaming stats, and withdraw earnings, all from the palm of their hand. And for those looking to perfect their sound, check out Mixia. With its simple interface and customizable mastering options, artists can make their music sound polished and professional within minutes. And don't forget about Instant Share, DistroKid's newest feature. Share large files securely with collaborators, producers, and more, ensuring your music streams at the highest quality. Ready to take your music to the next level? Download the DistroKid app and explore their suite of tools today. Plus, listeners can enjoy 30% off their first year by visiting distrokid.com/VIP/demakes. That's distrokid.com/VIP/demakes.
And now, back to the show.
Well, we hit this B chord. Now we're in bridge. What I'm calling bridge one. If there's maybe a bridge two, or what I'm also calling an outro at the end. But we're in a bridge now.
Call me selfish, call me what you like. I think it's right. It's what someone for all your own.
Call me selfish, call me what you like. I think it's right to want someone for all your own and not to share her love. Cause I'll have my way. You won't have a say anyway. Cause I got you. You don't stand a chance. And is that her saying, cause I got you, you don't stand a chance? Or is that you saying that?
That's me. This is something where I've actually done this song acoustically recently, where I've just changed those lyrics because they come across just a little, in the light of 2022, they just come across just a little toxic male, you know? And so I don't, you know, it's one of those things. I feel like at the time, being a 19-year-old kid, if I was feeling kind of bitter and angry about this, I might be like, I'm going to get my way. You know, I'm going to have my way. You won't have a say, you know, it does come across almost creepy. Like, I've got you, you don't stand a chance, you know? So I've actually modified the lyrics for that reason.
To want someone for all your own and not to share her love. I want to have my way. I know I got no say anyway, but I want you. So just give me a chance.
We've been called out on a bunch of different stuff that's questionable, but I've never been called on that. But that was just me self-critical about being a 19-year-old kid who didn't understand the way that, you know, romantic relationships or whatever. And that's what comes out from it. But yeah, mm-hmm. that's what that's all about. Just kind of like, you know, me being angry or bitter about the way things went down. But like, again, it's kind of saying, well, I'm just going to make it happen. I'm just going to make it happen somehow, basically, you know?
Right. Do you recall during this bridge part, it almost sounds like really super buried. Was the lead vocal double tracked here?
I don't think it was.
Okay. Well, maybe I'm hearing Bill doing a backup or something with you here. Cause it almost sounded like there's a ghosting of a double track that's not completely locked up with the lead vocal.
If there was, it was merely meant to be a double. There's clearly no need. There was no need or desire to have any, any kind of harmonizing or anything like that. It's pretty much unison, if anything, basically.
On the last line on "Cause I Got You," there's some dissonant, like a dissonant guitar overdub that comes in. That's very reminiscent of what Stefan would bring to the band later. Just really cool, like out of nowhere. It's like just this noodly thing that happens for like 3 or 4 seconds, and then it's gone. You recall stuff like that? Was that just what Frank was playing live and it just transferred to the studio? Or
yeah, Frank would do stuff that you would be like, whoa, did he mean to do that? And you know, it's not, you know, that was probably not an overdub. It was probably him hitting some weird harmonic, or him maybe not even meaning to, and Spot just being like, okay, that was the one, because Spot would hear it. Oh, that was the one. Whatever. I don't care if you meant to do that or not, but that's the one, you know? And I think maybe what it is, because I don't remember either directing him to do that or him having some idea like, oh, I'm going to insert this little bit here. I'm going to have to listen back to hear it now because I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I do believe that was probably an example of just like a happy mistake basically that ended up being on there, you know.
Gotcha.
And the thing about this bridge, the one thing I should mention about this bridge too, is that when I first showed the song to Bill, he was like, well, wait, what is this? Are you going through another verse here? I go, no, it's a bridge. But as you can tell, that the music for that bridge is pretty similar to the verse. It's just, instead of starting with a B minor, it starts with a G basically. Call me selfish, call me what you like. That's G to D. And so that's the only reason why it sounds different than the verse.
And you're right.
Yeah. So I had to convince Bill, no, this is cool. It's a bridge that has some similarity to the verse, but it stands on its own as a bridge. But yeah, I think other bands that have maybe even covered it have just, you know, treated it like another verse. It's like, no, that's a bridge, man. That's a bridge.
And you're right. I erroneously said that it was the key of B, but you're right. It is in G, and it is reminiscent of the verse. And I think that that's kind of something about younger songwriters. A lot of our stuff from verse to chorus might sound the same because we're still learning how to write and how to put stuff together.
Yeah, but I also think that I've heard songs where they throw a bridge in there and it just comes out of left field. And you're like, whoa, you know, so it can it can work to have a bridge that sounds like another part because then you're not kind of thrown off base. But, you know, I guess you want it to sound significantly like it can't be thrown out of left field, but it also can't just sound like another verse. I was trying to split the difference there. Yeah.
Well, there's some cool stuff rhythmically going on at the end of this bridge. Before we get into verse three, I love verse three because verse three is verse two except for one word. Mm. And then we get a double chorus here. That one word is cock, and it is. So now you wait for his cock. You know it'll turn you on. He's gonna make you feel the way you want to feel. When he starts to lie, when he makes you cry, you know I'll be there. My day will come. I know someday I'll be the only one. And that's repeated again, where we get that double chorus. Again, we get the Bill's vocals on the second line. He's gonna make you feel the way you want to feel. It's panned off to the right. My day will come. It's not panned left like it was in chorus two. It's still panned over to the right, which I thought was cool. And again, I think some of this stuff, like you said, is just happenstance. It's just kind of what went down in the studio, and it wasn't really too much thought at that point going into it.
Once I'm done with my vocal performance, I'm like, I'm out of here. So whatever spot does, and you know, I had no kind of standing to which to then to go behind the mixing board and go, hey, do this, do that. That would have been seen as like, you know, what?
Well, the reason I keep talking about the panning, and for the listeners, I'm going to kind of break this down in layman's terms. You know, the panning and volume adjustments when you mixed back then, they were done on the fly. There wasn't any automation going on. There was no computer. So it's like you're sitting there and you're like nodding at Bill going, okay, pan the vocal off to the left. And you're actually taking a button and turning that vocal so it'll go over to the left or to the right speaker. So it's just fascinating to know that that's what went on back then.
Yeah. But it wasn't going on in real time, obviously, because I was just singing. You know, I was just kind of like,
yeah,
just doing my thing. And then after the fact, they were going to do some panning. But I just want to go back to that one word, and I'm going to state what my recollection of that is that Bill wanted he's like, hey, dude, wouldn't it be cool if you said cock instead of spark? I go, okay.
We're going to throw Bill under the bus. I love it. You know, that was another thing was, you know, besides that one word, was it like, hey, we've already said this in verse two or whatever. It's punk rock. We're just going to say it again. That's kind of how it was with my early stuff. It's like, we're going to repeat the verse again.
Yeah. It didn't have to be the C word. It could have been whatever. It could have been something, but to make it be slightly different than the first time around, you know? So that was, I'm sure that was part of the thinking. But yeah, it was one of these, you know, It meant that Casey Kasem could never play that song, though.
Yeah, you weren't getting on American Bandstand in anytime soon, little Dick Clark. I love the next part because it's kind of like the second bridge, but I'm calling it an outro. And it comes in on a C sharp minor, which again, you're talking about those minor chords. And there's a sadness here with this, but it is hopeful. But at the same time, the song's about your girlfriend leaving you. There's a lot going on here.
So now you want perfection. I feel self-destruction. You don't know what you want. It's gonna take you years to find out. I'm not giving up. And when you've had enough, you'll take your brutal hand and you'll come running back to me. You know that I'm gonna be the only one.
So now you want perfection. I see your self-destruction. You don't know what you want. It's going to take you years to find out. Before I go any further, when did you realize that Face to Face stole your lyric?
Well, someone told me that this is Glenn. and I said, this band, Face to Face, man, they stole your lyric. And I was like, cool. You know, I think that's pretty rad because it's in the coda, for God's sakes. It's not even, they made a chorus out of my coda. So that's cool.
No, you don't know what you want to give up. You don't know.
They changed one word, though. They say, you don't know what you want. It may take you years to find out. So they get the third of the writing credit for that one word, old third. But I remember listening to that and being like, wait a second. How do I know that lyric? Oh, I know why I know that lyric.
Yeah.
The rest of the lyric here is, I'm not giving up. And when you've had enough, you'll take your bruised little head and you'll come running back to me. You know that I'm going to be the only one. And that's one thing here, bruised little head. Is that a metaphor for what's going on in her head, or was the boyfriend abusive in any way?
No, it was a metaphor. Yeah, it was more like, you know, your brain gets kind of bruised, or I guess it really be your heart, but maybe heart didn't sound good enough, you know. So it was definitely metaphorical, not really a real thing. Yeah, but so the very first song that I write for the band, I decide I have to write a coda to a song. it can't just end with a chorus, or it can't just end with something, you know. Normally you'd end the song with a chorus, but no, I had to write a freaking coda.
Yeah, all of a sudden you're in Queen. It's like, what's going on?
But I mean, and the funny thing is that I have just a bad habit of doing that. I wrote codas for songs on Hypercaffeum. I mean, like Smile has a coda.
Game well played.
It's like my weakness or whatever. I have a weakness for the coda, I guess. And
yeah, I think you did it with Tack from Cool to Be You. That's another one.
Yeah,
of yours. That's just awesome.
I was in another world. Time for a new me.
It's weird. It's like they've got to do that. I don't know why that is, but yeah.
The only backing vocals are on the very last line. I'm going to be the only one. They're panned left. And then the last vocal you hear, and I'm going to assume this is Bill panned off left, there's like a quick only one that happens.
You know that I'm gonna be the only one.
I guess that's the one example where I did the backup because I...
Oh, that's you. Yeah, okay.
So I think I did the whole track. We double tracked what needed to double track. And then I just go, I got this one idea for the very ending, and I'm going to go, I'm going to be the only one, like a Frank Sinatra thing or something. Like, I'm going to croon this. And that's probably why you can only hear only one. You can't hear the, I'm going to be the only one. Because it was me trying to just add something croony to the very end. And so that was that idea, which I don't ever do that live. But I did do it. I did this recent thing for Taylor Guitars where I did it with Stefan and Carl, where we played acoustic guitars, and I did do it for that, just because I thought, well, you know, it's acoustic, so it'll show up, basically.
I'm not giving up, and when you've had enough, you take your bruised little head and come running back to me. You know
I love the rhythmic change here at the end to end the song, at the very end. F sharp, C sharp, D to A, F sharp, C sharp, D to A. That's the only time you get it that fast. It's great.
That, I'm sure that was just like, I'm sitting here like, I've got this coda. How do I end the song? Oh, I'll just play the chorus double time.
Yeah.
That's the chorus double time. And yeah, so it was a fun way to end it. And it solved the problem of how do you end with a coda, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you get the mixes back from Spot. You hear the song. Do you remember hearing the mix back for the first time? What did you think of it?
No, I was totally uninvolved with all that. And the reason why is because I did go to college. Milo went to college. We finished tracking in probably August, I guess. And I had to go down to school. So I think I might have told Bill, hey, send me a cassette, you know, of the mixes. And I do not remember getting a cassette of any mixes, masters, or anything. The next thing I know, I'm not complaining at all. This is just how it worked out. But the next thing I know, my roommate is saying, hey, there's a guy down the street who has a record with your name on the cover. Are you Milo Goes to College? Is that the one? Is that something that you did? I go, yeah, that's my band from up in LA. And he goes, well, I want to go down the hit street and listen to it. And I go, I want to go too, because I haven't heard it yet.
That's incredible.
So I walked down the street with this guy to his friend's house, and we put the needle down on Milo Goes to College, and I'm listening to it for the first time. I didn't hear mixes. I didn't hear masters or anything like that. I just heard it. I heard the vinyl version of it when it actually emerged. And it was really kind of surreal, because I'm sitting here, I'm listening to it as you might listen to it in the recording studio, and with a very discerning ear, you know, fully like, and you know, like focused on it. And these guys around me are like, why this guy's acting like he never heard this before. It's like, no, I haven't.
You
I
didn't. Haven't. one last thing before we break. So, you know, you go off to college, the band continues on. You made a couple more records with them. They splintered off into All and got a couple different singers over the years. And then it's the early 90s. And during this time, there's just this groundswell, and punk rock's becoming more popular, more popular. When did it dawn on you, before Everything Sucks, okay, before 96, when you guys made the comeback album and went out, and again, there was no money to be made in the 80s on punk rock. You did these songs when you were a kid, 19, 20, 21 years old. What was it like 10 years after the fact that people are clamoring for this music and going crazy for it?
It was definitely not something, you know, I expected. I saw the whole Green Day Offspring explosion happened, and I liked both those bands, and I thought, cool, you know, I felt gratified that punk was kind of, you know, bubbling up and in fact exploding really at that point.
Yeah.
And so I was really excited about it. I mean, perhaps that's the reason why I, you know, got back together. One of the reasons I got back together with the band is just I kind of rediscovered my enthusiasm for that kind of raw, more raw music. I mean, I spent probably the late 80s and early 90s, you know, listening to kind of more indie music. I was like a Pixies fan, that kind of thing, Nirvana.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think through that whole period, I listened to All, and All was the band that kind of, I kept the torch alive for the Descendants, basically.
Oh yeah.
And so I was still kind of in the loop with those guys, and I started writing music again, pretty much due to kind of some dissatisfaction with my professional life as a scientist. I just was like, I needed an outlet for that kind of frustration and dissatisfaction. And so I started writing songs again, and I showed him the bill, and that kind of jump-started, you know, Everything Sucks at that point. And so although I'd left it behind, I hadn't left it behind kind of spiritually, I guess is the way to put it. It was still right. Something that was so important to me, and All I thought was the best band in the world. And I guess I kind of kept my fire alive by listening to All and going to see them occasionally, and occasionally getting on stage with them. I played a show in City Gardens,
yes,
New Jersey, in probably 93, I would imagine 93, 94, maybe 94, where they just needed someone to step on because Chad was sick. And so throughout that whole period where I wasn't with the band, I was, I guess, kind of, I continued to kind of stir the embers, you know,
yeah.
Might blow on the embers and stir the embers and kind of keep those embers going. And then we just kind of reignited it in 95, 96, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, well, when I first heard Everything Sucks, me and my whole band were absolutely blown away. Of course, Caffeine Nation tour, when your comeback tour, you guys, the first leg, you took Suicide Machines out. Less Than Jake was lucky enough to get the second leg. We were selling a few records then. And I just, what was it like for you? Because the crowds went nuts for you guys on that. And that wasn't what was happening when you were playing some of the punk dives in the 80s. It's like it all came together. And like, yes, you did the City Gardens gig, but that had to just be an eye opener for you. Like, oh my gosh. I mean, we weren't playing small places. It was 1,000 to 2,000, sometimes 3,000 seats a night, sold out every night. It was crazy.
Yeah. It was definitely unexpected. It made that one year. I mean, I think the thing what happened is that, you know, we recorded Everything Sucks. And initially, there was no commitment beyond like, hey, we got these songs, let's make a record. And at some point during the recording of that, I said, we should tour. I wanted to tour because I saw that these songs were great. You know, I felt like you can make a record and then just have it kind of fade into the woodwork and not tour to support it or whatever. But I thought we should tour to support it. They just, the songs deserved that much. And so that's when, yeah, we started putting a tour together. And it was crazy. We played more that one year in 96 than we've ever played before and since. Definitely and since. I mean, we were out on the road a lot, and it was a crazy fun experience and exhausting as well. So at the end of that one year of doing it, I went back to my science career. And I think everyone was kind of like, yeah, we need to take a little break here, because we were just completely thrashed after as much touring as we did. I think the thing that happened is that once you play to those places and you can see the spiritual kind of connection you can have with an audience, or just the kind of how you can make a big party out of it. We play in the 80s, we were more playing for ourselves, and we'd play to empty rooms and be like, oh, it's okay, we're just playing for each other. But in the 90s, you were playing for, like you said, thousands of people. Mm-hmm. That becomes something that's something you can shrug your shoulders about and go, eh, okay, back to my whatever. So I think every time I go back to my science, I'd be a little bit more hooked, bit more like, ah, I don't think I'm giving this up, maybe.
Well, I think it's the coolest thing in the world that something you did 12 to 15 years prior came to fruition that much later. And it was just so cool to see with my own two eyes. And before we wrap up here, anything you'd like to leave the listeners with, and anything going on with the band yourself that you'd like to share?
No, just to reiterate what you're saying, it's just that we feel really fortunate that I guess that this, whatever, the sands of time did not gum up our gears, because the sands of time have been known to gum up people's gears. For us, it just seemed to be the sands of time were somehow, now I'm gonna, my metaphor's breaking down, never mind. Anyways, I think the time stood us well in terms of being able to kind of weather these long hiatuses and just kind of come back kind of. And part of that is just that we have such a strong bond with each other, and the desire to kind of make it happen, and the desire to take on the challenge of how do you do this as a increasingly aging punk rocker. You know, every time we go back out and do it, I kind of think, well, this is the next challenge, you know, and maybe the next challenge is that, you know, we're going to have to be doing it like in wheelchairs or whatever, but you know, it doesn't matter. If that's the challenge, that's the challenge. We're going to embrace.
That's the next record. Milo goes to the nursing home.
Yeah. Milo goes to the nursing home. Exactly. But anyways, we are still continuing to play. And, we were out with, Rise Against last fall or last late summer. And we've been playing out this year a little bit. It doesn't kick into full gear until probably fall, where we're really going to be hitting a lot of the US. But then, yeah, fall is going to be when we hit it heavy. Right now, we're just doing festivals and, you know, stuff like that, going over to Europe a few times. COVID, of course, put the kibosh on all of it. And so I think a lot of bands are coming back with a vengeance, like, okay, you know, we're kind of like, we're all pent up and we got to get out and, like, you know,
show make up for lost time.
Yeah, show people we can still rock. You know, that's kind of part of it. So, yeah.
Right on, man. Well, hey, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
There's lots more Chris DeMakes a Podcast after a few words from our sponsors.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, Chris Makes a Podcast producer, Chris Fafalius here. You may have heard me talk about my band Punchline before. Maybe you already know us, or maybe you're hearing about us for the first time right now. It doesn't matter. No matter what your relationship with Punchline is, I will absolutely guarantee that you'll love our new podcast, A Band Called Punchline. Starting with our humble beginnings in a small town in southwestern Pennsylvania in 1997, we're telling the hilarious, strange, and hopefully inspiring story of the 25 plus years of our band in the most honest way possible, podcast style. A Band Called Punchline is an audio documentary available now wherever you get your pods. So subscribe and let me and my friends share a wild, entertaining, unique, and wonderful tale of music and perseverance unlike any other that's still being written today.
End of the show. Here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is email your song via MP3 only and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Old Currents from Glen Rock, New Jersey. They recently released their new album, The Glory, The Defeat. You can find their music on all the streaming platforms. Here's a snippet of their song, Here. You Throw This Away.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Chris, were you proud of me for the level of restraint that I showed when we got on this call with Milo and I didn't fanboy and I was totally professional? I was just like, hey, Milo, nice to meet you. Been a fan forever. Here's how this is going to go. Because I was proud of me for that.
Well, Chris, I'm always proud of you. But in this particular instance, yes, I was very, very proud of you. You were very well behaved.
It took a lot of restraint. I didn't want to geek out too hard. I think that Milo would be an okay guy to do that with. I don't think he would take offense to that or think it's weird. But I practiced restraint. This episode was awesome. I'm sure that everybody listening to this episode feels the same way. I have so many notes about this episode. Like, as I was listening, I was laughing out loud at certain parts that I want to talk about. But the first thing I wanted to talk about with this, and Chris, I know you and I have talked to each other about this before, but it's really cool thinking about with the old school punk rock days that by the time you got to the studio, you have played the song live maybe for years. You may have played this at shows hundreds of times to the point where the song is worked out. There's nothing you're figuring out in the studio. The song is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So there doesn't need to be a lot of notes in the studio.
No, not at all. I think that, and I touched on this with Milo, a lot of the bands, you know, any band's first recording, especially punk rock bands, there's this just immediate ball of energy thrown onto tape that was just, that's what you sounded like live. And I think that's why a lot of people like my band's first records, it had, that's what we sound like. You threw up some mics and capture what we were, and then you could never really do that again because your subsequent albums weren't, you didn't have 3, 4, 5 years to play those songs. You had to write them and go record them.
Right. You didn't get to see how the crowd reacted to the song,
right,
to know whether you're going to keep it or not. You kind of just got to guess. It's a shot in the dark.
Yeah.
Something he touched on, which I think is a huge appeal of the Descendants for me and for a lot of people. You probably feel the same way. Is that he said they don't write from imagination. They write from experience. I think that's the best way to write songs because it's real. And, you know, with the Descendants even taking it a little bit further, because they write from experience, I really feel that as you listen to their albums, the subject matter relates to that point in your life that they're at in their point in their life.
Uh-huh.
There were a lot of songs and bands that I felt like I outgrew because they're still writing about as if they're like a 20-year-old. But the Descendants, as you go through the albums, it's like, oh yeah, I'm experiencing these same things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I think the term for that is timeless, and something that I've used on this show, and I hate to be cliche about it, but you know, this band was ahead of its time. They were writing songs from the heart that later on, when you know, me as a fan, when I became the age they were when they wrote it, I could totally relate. And they've just continued to resonate. As he said, like, here we are 40 years later still talking about a song he wrote when he was 19 that probably has more relevance now than it's ever had.
It was pretty wild when he was talking about the subject matter of the song. He kept censoring himself, like, I'm not going to say the name of the girl that this song's about. But the story behind it being that she straight up said to him, hey, I'm going to leave you when this guy comes back, which is such a thing that would happen when you're young. I mean, I guess that could happen when you're older, but to straight up be like, hey, when this guy comes back from the military, I'm going to leave you for him. It's just such a weird situation.
Yeah, when you're, you know, 39 years old and your significant other tells you that, you're probably not sticking around for very long, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're probably not thinking like, well, how can I win this? How can I win your love? And something that I knew Milo was going to get into with this song, and he'd probably talk about this with a lot of Descendants songs, at least a few of them, is when I listen to interviews with him, I'm always impressed because he's obviously super intelligent and evolved guy. We all have lyrics from the past where now when we think about them, we're like, I don't feel the same way about things as I did back then. But I think it's cool that he could look critically. He cited that some of these lyrics in the song come across as like toxic male, like I'm kind of like I'm going to own you or something like that, which may not have been the intentions, but he can look at them and be like, yeah, I see how that could come across that way. I love that he can talk about that. I've heard him in other interviews talk about things like that too.
Yeah, there's definitely stuff that I've sung about or way I wrote and sang and performed that I just don't do anymore. It's just because I was young and you can look back and yeah, I think there's a little bit of self censoring and editing that goes on with all of us, you know. And he might feel maybe even a little embarrassed. He even said it. He goes out and plays it acoustic. It kind of changes up a lyric here or there. But I just think that you're kind of evolving as not just a performer but as a human. It's kind of cool
when you're in a band or you're an artist, you're putting out your emotions and anger that maybe 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years later in this instance, you might be like, that was just what I was feeling at the time. And I don't necessarily think it's the greatest, but yeah, I think it's awesome that Milo can address that. Not everybody does. There's a lot of people out there like, screw it. I still feel the same way. And I really respect Milo for that. I laughed out loud because I knew that the cock line was coming up. And I'm like, I can't wait to hear what he says about this. And when he threw Bill under the bus and told the story of like, wouldn't it be funny if you said cock here? I seriously was laughing out loud over here. That was awesome.
No, and I love that verse because it's verbatim. Verse 3 is verbatim of verse 2, except for they just replaced the word spark with cock. It's great.
Yeah. It's so funny. I love that you talked about his weakness for the coda. The coda is something we don't talk about much on this show.
Not too much, no. And I love the ending of this song. I love how, and this just kind of goes to show you the, I don't want to say juvenile, but they were young. They're just going with those guttural instincts. Like, hey, let's just double time the chorus chords here, and that's how we're going to end the song. And it's just awesome.
I honestly think that's one of the best parts of the song. You know that I will be the only one. I can't believe we didn't talk about this, but that's, I always hear Bradley Knoll singing that. Sublime famously covered this
song.
Mm-hmm.
What you want is gonna take you years by now. I'm not giving up. And when you've had enough, you'll take your brutal head and you'll come running back to me. I know that I will be the only one.
I'm sure a lot of people, that's how they heard this song for the first time.
Quite possibly, yeah. And I know, again, I had referenced Face to Face with that lyric. I know people went back from that because I remember that was a huge debate in the early on. How could they do the rip off that lyric? And it wasn't so much a rip off. It was an homage to the band. They were huge right. Descendants fans. And of course, Face to Face went on their Big Choice album. They covered Bikage.
Sitting there with your mouth full of beer, your eyes ablaze, face is red. Who's gonna pick you up and use you for tonight? Not me, not me. When you're on the streets with a needle in your eyes.
Oh yeah, right. I forgot about that too.
Yeah.
Dude, how about the story of him not having heard the album and somebody comes up to him and goes, are you the Milo from like the record in the record store? And he's like, yeah, that's me. Could you imagine not ever hearing your album, going and buying it and listening to it on vinyl with like a buddy?
Again, no, it's unfathomable almost, but this is before social media, before the internet. The only reference point you had was to walk your butt to the store, go in and get a record and look at the back of it and go, wait a second, that looks like my buddy's roommate down the road. I wonder if it's him. who else is named Milo Aukerman? It's got to be the same dude, right? And the fact that he didn't hear the mixes till then of his own record because he was off studying about biology and science, it's hilarious.
It's so funny that Milo is that cartoon. That's like one of the most famous logos in punk rock history. It is him. It is the guy you were just talking to. That is literally him. What a strange, weird thing. It's so cool.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I mentioned it at the end, but I'm honored to have lived that sliver of history with seeing the band come back 15 years later in 97 after the debut record, 15 years later, and all the fruits of their labor. All those dumpy dives that they played and the fights and the vans breaking down and the parents not understanding what they're doing and punk rock being a four-letter word. And here they came back and I saw those crowds, man. They were rabid. Absolutely rabid for this band. Here's songs they wrote when they were 19. Now they're in their early 30s playing them and actually making a living at that point. It was awesome to see.
That's amazing that you were literally on that tour and they came back. That is absolutely incredible. We did a whole episode of the After Party about it, which, man, this would have been a perfect place for me to do my famous segues to talking about our supporting cast, which, yes, if you're not part of our supporting cast, we release a supplemental episode called the After Party every week. Go to chrystomakes.com. Become part of our supporting cast for a couple bucks. For a couple bucks a month, you support the podcast. You keep this going. Okay, I did the segue, but I'm going to reel it back because there's one more thing I want to talk about, Chris, is that I really loved that Milo talked about All. Because in my head, it's always all these conversations I've had over the years with friends like, what do you like better, All or Descendants? We all know it's the same band with different singers. You know, we all yeah. We all know that, but it's like almost like a funny argument or conversation. And to hear Milo talk about how All kept the fire burning and how big of a fan he was of All, I don't know, that was like worlds colliding, even though it should have been obvious, but I just thought that was really cool.
Yeah, and he talks about that City Garden show he did around 93 or 94 when Chad got sick, and that's kind of folklore at this point, a famous show he stepped in. And it just goes to show they were always family. That's another thing I loved about the band. Everyone had a say in the writing. It's a page out of their book that my band took. It was always kind of like, hey, you keep the unit together. You keep your secrets together. You don't feed the press and the fans with garbage. You keep your stuff to yourself, but you treat everyone equally. Everyone has a say. It's a dynamic that has worked for them. And I think it's the best way to approach a band. Kudos to them.
I love it, man. I feel like the Descendants / All / anyone in that camp really wrote the book. They should literally write the book on how to be a punk rock band. I think it's amazing. And I'm going to quit ranting and raving here. Yeah, this was a great episode. If you enjoyed it, once again, chrystomakes.com, where you can join our supporting cast. You can help us continue making this podcast. Chris, what else is happening? Anything else? Anything else we got to plug here at the end?
You know, not too much. Just if you can, give me a follow on Instagram at @lessthanchrisd. I'd love to have you be one of my followers. I like that. And if you'd like a custom song for me or a jingle, I'm still doing those. Hit me up at chrystomakes@gmail.com. And I don't know what else there is to say, Chris. Just want to thank this week's guest, Milo Aukerman, for sitting in with us. He's a hero of mine and a friend. Much love to him, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, Chris Ophalius here. You know, the producer of the podcast that you're listening to right now. Did you know that I also host a music podcast? It's called One Hit Thunder, and it's a weekly show all about one-hit wonders. We have great guests, and we discuss one one-hit wonder artist each week. Some of the songs are great, some of them are terrible, but either way, the show is always pretty freaking good. I know, I'm biased because I host it, but seriously, go subscribe to One Hit Thunder right now. I promise you'll like it.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.